Going into Election Day, the hope among most members of the Republican hierarchy was that Donald Trump wouldn't get slaughtered at the polls so that the GOP could maintain the majorities in both the House and the Senate. The results, yeah, better than those who claimed to know thought they would be. With us now to examine what was thought versus what actually happened and what that means moving forward in Washington is the chief political correspondent for National Review, Tim Alberta. Thanks for being here today, Tim.
Thank you for having me.
NationalReview.com is the website. So at what point, either Tuesday night or Wednesday morning, did you look at what was happening and say, oh my God, Trump got it?
I think when we saw, you know, it's all sort of a blur, frankly, looking back on it, but I think that the point at which I realized, wow, he's going to win was after it was pretty clear already that he was going to win Florida and that he had pulled ahead North Carolina, he was going to win there as well. And the question had always been, you know, if he could win those two states, then where could he get across the finish line? Because he wasn't going to do it at the time in Pennsylvania. Now, he did wind up winning Pennsylvania, but at the time, he was still way, way down in Pennsylvania. So we start looking across the map, and he was ahead both in Michigan and Wisconsin. And it looked as though Michigan was going to narrow quite a bit, and it has. I think at this point, they haven't even finished counting the votes. Trump is about 10,000 or 12,000 votes ahead in Michigan, but he was way ahead in Wisconsin. And as the night went on, I was watching Wisconsin very closely and looking at the returns in Milwaukee, and it was way, way down in Milwaukee. The turnout in that city, which of course is a majority black city and is really a Democratic stronghold in the state, the voter participation was down so drastically. And as I was doing the math, looking at all the different precincts in that state, I said, he's going to win Wisconsin. And if he does, he's going to win the election. And that was kind of when it hit me, and I said it to somebody who was with me, and they said no. And I was actually in Wisconsin. I was with Paul Ryan at the speaker's reception there, and I said it to somebody there, a Republican who works for Ryan, and he said, no, he's not going to win Wisconsin. And I said, I think he is. And, you know, things kind of moved very quickly from there, and sure enough, he did win Wisconsin, and he did pull ahead in Pennsylvania. So not only did he just kind of barely get across the finish line, but, you know, when all the electoral votes are tallied here, he's going to win by a pretty significant margin.
And you wrote for National Review, the article was entitled, Trump Bulldozes Blue Wall, Wins White House. So for the Democrats, when they're looking at states like Pennsylvania, like Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, and they see red instead of blue, you know, when they sit down at their next conclave or convention or gathering and say, okay, boys and girls, what do we do now?
Well, the problem that they have is twofold. Start with what I was referring to a minute ago, which is turnout in some of the big urban areas in the industrial Midwest. So if you look at Detroit, and if you look at Wayne County, where Detroit is in Michigan, the biggest county in the state by far, and Detroit is the garrison of the Democratic Party. If they turn out their voters in Detroit, then they're going to win Michigan. If they don't, then they're in trouble. And you saw a significant, about a 23-24% drop-off in voter turnout from 2012 to 2016. And in fact, Barack Obama won about, I think the number was about 600,000 votes in Wayne County 4 years ago, about 600,000. Hillary Clinton is at about 480,000. So that right there is about a 25% drop-off. So it's just you can't win that way. You can't win when 25% of your voters decide to stay home in your single biggest stronghold in a state. We saw the same thing in Milwaukee. We saw the same thing in Cuyahoga County in Ohio, which is where Cleveland is. You know, the Democratic Party is not built to sustain that kind of loss. So that's the one side of the equation. And then, of course, the other side of the equation is, you know, the Democratic Party has alienated so many white working class voters over the last 10 years. And really, you know, especially over the last, I would argue, 6 years. And that is a problem for the party because when their Democratic base does not turn out, young people and suburban women and, of course, African Americans and Hispanics, when they do not turn out the way that they didn't on Tuesday, you can't afford to have the white working class voters in these upper Midwestern states vote against you as almost a block. And that's what we saw on Tuesday night. That's a group that was trending towards the Republican Party much more sharply in recent years. But what we saw Tuesday night was historic numbers of white non-college educated workers in those four states, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, those Rust Belt states. They voted against the Democratic Party at historic rates. And when you add those two things up, the historic rate at which white working class voters fled the Democratic Party and the Democratic Party's sort of minority base in those cities not showing up, it was a clear recipe for a defeat.
So Tim Halberta, who is the chief political correspondent for National Review, nationalreview.com, is a website you're listening to Issues and Ideas. And this is not to say that all is peace and quiet on the Republican side. You have, of course, the Never Trumpers who were very vocal during the campaign. Trump goes into Washington in January with pretty much without the support of any of the politicians from Utah, just as a starter. So at that point in time, what is the onus now more on Trump to build the bridge or the Republicans in Congress to build a bridge to Trump?
It's a good question. You know, I think that what you're going to see over the next few years in Washington within the Republican Party is some asymmetrical warfare. I just don't think that we are at a point anymore where we can sort of label this a, you know, conservative versus moderate fight or a Tea Party versus establishment. I mean, Trump fits in none of those boxes, right? I mean, this is a guy who stepped into kind of a years-long Republican civil war, and he redrew the battle lines, and he ran very much as sort of an outsider populist, but without any conservative, you know, ideological framework to his campaign. And he certainly was not a member of the establishment, so nobody really knows where to slot Trump in. And now on the one side of him, you do have, you know, Paul Ryan as the Speaker of the House and Mitch McConnell as the Senate Majority Leader and these leaders in Congress who are very much sort of part of the political establishment now, and they will be looking to try and get, you know, some policy things accomplished now that they have a unified Republican government. But on the other side of them, you still have some of the Tea Partiers and some of the conservatives in the House Freedom Caucus, for example, and these guys are going to be looking to get things done also, but probably things that are much more conservative and a little bit farther to the right than what their leaders want to get done. So what side does Trump fall on, if any? Does he want to do something completely different? I don't think that you're going to see sort of clear battle lines drawn within the Republican Party over the next few years, which is going to be fascinating. I think that there's this narrative, this perception that, well, you know, Trump's victory sort of ends the Republican infighting that we've seen. I would actually take the exact opposite perspective. I think that if anything, this is sort of going to accelerate the Republican infighting and sort of bring it to a whole new place where you have three or four big, rambunctious factions who have their own very clearly held ideas for, you know, what the party should do now that it controls government. And I don't know that those views are going to be reconcilable. We'll see. But I would expect there to be quite a bit of sort of internal jockeying as soon as the new Congress convenes in January and as soon as President-elect Trump is inaugurated on the 20th.
You have to wrap here, but when you think about that, even before we get to this point and the Trump win on election night, here is an individual that ended two political dynasties, for all intents and purposes, the Bush and the Clinton dynasties.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, listen, for whatever anyone wants to say about Donald Trump's candidacy, whether they love him or they hate him and they're somewhere in between, that fact is absolutely incredible to consider. Ending the dynasties of these two families that have essentially ruled American politics for a quarter century is unheard of. It's just something that nobody could have ever expected, and especially not from somebody like Donald Trump, who has not a lick of political experience. And it just goes to show just the incredible power of this outsider sentiment that so many voters wanted somebody to just come in and take out the trash and shake up the system and bring in some fresh blood. And that is something we heard from voters all across the country over the last 18 months, and they made good on it on Election Day.
He's the chief political correspondent for National Review, nationalreview.com. On the web, Tim Halberta. Tim, thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having me.